Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
We have to come together and sometimes learn some songs that might be newer to us. And this is one of those songs, Listen to Our Hearts. It may be very familiar to you. It may not be quite as familiar to some. And so we'll sing through both verses. If you know it, please sing out as we reflect on pouring out our hearts to God. How do you explain? How do you describe a love that goes from east to west and runs as deep as it is wide? You know all our hopes, Lord, you know all our fears. And words cannot express the love we feel, but we long for you to hear. So listen to our hearts and hear our spirits sing a song of praise that flows from those you have redeemed. And we will use the words we know to tell you what an awesome God you are. But words are not enough to tell you of our love. So listen to our hearts. If words could fall like rain from these lips of mine, and if I had 1,000 years, Lord, I would still run out of time. If you listen to my heart, every beat will say, thank you for the life, and thank you for the truth, and thank you for the way. So listen to our hearts, and hear our spirits sing a song of praise that flows from those you have redeemed. We will use the words we know to tell you what an awesome God you are. But words are not enough to tell you of our love. So listen to our hearts. But words are not enough to tell you of our love. So listen to our hearts. It's a beautiful song with a beautiful message. If you would be turning to John chapter 9. John chapter 9. We'll begin there in just a moment. I just want to reiterate something that Wendell has mentioned today, and others may have pointed out to you, the postcards we have with those movie tickets on them, reminding us about these Friday nights, movie nights that we're inviting everyone to. Those are ideal to take to a workplace, a break room, or to hand to some of your neighbors. I know at the last Friday night movie, the first one, there were some families present that were guests that don't attend here, that were just there to be part of that event. And so this is an excellent way to get to reach out to people and get to know them. I'm really excited that we're doing this. And so I hope we can make an effort to spread the word and be thinking of people that you can invite just to be a part of that. Not only to have good fellowship, but also to maybe help people make some connections with other Christians. We're going to spend most of our time in John chapter 9 this evening. And it's a story about blindness. It's a story about sight. And I think there are some powerful messages here, but I need to begin with somewhat of a confession. I need to just admit something to you. I don't know a lot about country music. I don't know much about country music. I'm not against country music. I just never listened to it very much. I grew up in the South. live in Middle Tennessee. I realize it's kind of strange not to know much about country music, but I just don't. I have several friends that do, that enjoy it, and that's fine. So, you know, you don't have to come up to me later tonight and try to defend country music. It's okay. I don't have anything against it. I just don't know much about it. So a few years ago, when I was reading through an article in the Tennessean, and I read about a musician named Ronnie Millsap, that name didn't ring much of a bell to me. You may be familiar with him. I don't know much about his music, but I did think this interview was interesting. Because in the interview, he described what it was like to grow up without being able to see. He described what it was like to be blind, and even specifically said there were some young men that he met at an early age that wanted to take him to a revival. And they said, if you go to this revival with us, then we'll take you and we'll go to this healing service and you will be healed of your blindness and you'll be able to see. And so as a young man, he was anticipating that. He would ride in the car just waiting, just eager to see what would happen. And if he'd be healed, he anticipated being able to see out the car window on the way back. But as he was quoted in this article in the Tennessean, he said, "They said all I needed was the faith of a mustard seed and I could be healed. And they were so nice to me on the way to the meetings. But then I was never healed, of course. Miracles didn't happen for me. And because I wasn't healed, they were usually very unkind to me as we drove home." And I thought one of the most poignant statements was when he said, "They thought my blindness was a flaw of my faith." Now, there are a few things that just saddened me when I read this article, and that's why I saved it. It saddened me that there were a group of people that were telling a young person that was dealing with blindness that it was somehow his fault. That there was the ability for healing to be there, even though that doesn't check out with what we see in the New Testament. But there was this miraculous ability of healing that was there for him if he just had enough faith. Can you imagine the guilt that that would have placed on someone? "They thought that my blindness was a flaw of my faith." That quote stood out to me, and it reminded me of this passage in John chapter 9, where we read about a blindness that is healed and a blindness that is not healed. And so as we think about two individuals, we're going to start by looking at a blind person that receives sight. Because John chapter 9 tells us about the blind receiving sight, and if we can understand that, we can understand the kinds of questions people were asking, the responses others had, and then what that means. John structures the first part of his gospel around seven different signs. You have these different miraculous signs that take place. And he doesn't focus as much on parables or prophecies as we see in other gospels. He focuses on these signs, these miracles, which in many cases are almost like living examples of parables. He's teaching messages with these miracles. And several of the chapters in John have to do with some of the Jewish feasts. Chapter 5, for instance, takes place on a Sabbath. Chapter 6 on a Passover. And chapter 7, 8, and 9, where we find the blind receiving sight here, take place at the Feast of Booths. And there's an emphasis throughout all of this of Jesus not only taking them through a physical process, but also through a spiritual process. So if we could, let's go to the next slide and look at the physical process that Jesus is guiding them through when you have the blind that would receive sight here. As he comes up to this individual, I'd like for you to notice how Jesus mentions that he is the light of the world. Because like I said, chapter 7, 8, and 9 have to deal with the festival or the feast of booths, of tabernacles. And as you think about that in chapter 7, 8, and 9, there's also the theme of Jesus being the light. John 8, 12 is when he describes himself as the light of the world. And when we think back to this feast of booths, on the first night there was a lampstand or a candelabra that was placed, that was lit and that provided powerful illumination against the night sky on that first night. And so that image would have been fresh on their mind during this time. And Jesus is saying, "I am the true light." And so let's begin reading in verse 9. And see how Jesus responds to a man who has been blind from the day he was born. Verse 1, "As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, 'Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind?' Jesus answered, 'It was neither that this man sinned, nor his parents, but it was so that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he had said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and applied clay to his eyes and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went away and washed and came back seeing. Therefore the neighbors and those who previously saw him as a beggar were saying, is not this the one who used to sit and beg? Others were saying, this is he. Still others were saying, no, but he is like him. He kept saying, I am the one. Now let's pause right there for just a moment. When they encountered this man who was born blind, did you notice that they're asking the same kind of question that we read about in that article? In other words, they looked at the situation and they said, I wonder who's to blame for this. I wonder whose fault it is. Was it his parents' fault? Did they sin? Is that why he was born without sight? Was it his fault? There were some Jewish teachers that even, or rabbis that would teach that you could do something in the womb that was wrong or that was sinful. So maybe it was his fault. Maybe he did something wrong. They're trying to pinpoint blame. And isn't that natural as human beings? Isn't that a natural response? I wonder whose fault this is. Here's a situation. I wonder who I should blame for this. Who's really responsible for this? And yet Jesus teaches them very clearly that that's not the approach to have. When they said, who sinned, this man or his parents? He says, neither did. You're asking the wrong question. The question is, what can we do? While I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. You're trying to blame someone else, but that game isn't going to take you very far. That's not the right approach. You need to be looking at how you're going to respond. And so we see that although there are times when we could make sinful decisions, and those sinful decisions can have consequences. We've seen that before. We see it in Scripture. We see it in our lives. We don't need to make the same mistake the apostles did and assume that any time something bad or something difficult happens to us or that we face a challenge, that it's because we've done something wrong. In fact, Jesus says that isn't true. We can even turn back to the Old Testament book of Job and see that's not true. The rain falls on the just and the unjust. When Jesus describes the wise and the foolish builders, both who had built their house, no matter what they built it on, whether it was a good foundation or it wasn't, both experienced the storm. And so it doesn't matter if we are Christians or not, in the sense that neither will exempt us from facing trials. Even if I am a Christian, I'm going to face trials. There are going to be challenges that happen to me that aren't a result of sin. And so it's important to understand that. Jesus says it was neither this man nor his parents. And then he refers to himself as the light of the world. And he gives him instructions and sends him to a pool of Siloam. And I think we have a picture of that. If we can go one slide back and just look at sort of the modern day picture of the pool of Siloam here coming out through Hezekiah's tunnel there. That's what it would look like today if you were going to look at one portion of it. But what Jesus does in this physical process is he makes clay, puts it in his eyes, and then sends him to the pool of Siloam. Now, we see Jesus heal in several different kinds of ways. Sometimes Jesus will touch someone and heal them. Sometimes he will just simply pronounce them healed and they will be healed. Here he does something interesting. He puts this clay in his eyes and then he sends him to the pool of Siloam. It's translated sent, as the Gospel of John tells us. And so he sends him to Siloam, translated sent. Have you ever thought about what it would have been like for him to make his way to the pool of Siloam? At this point, he's still not able to see. Sometimes it can be hard for us to move even across a room without being able to see. And we know he was used to life without the ability of sight, and yet he still had to make the effort to go where Jesus had pointed him. He had to make the effort to follow up in that obedience. And so after we have the clay, after he washes in the pool of Siloam, he obeyed Jesus and he came back seeing. And what's interesting is the reaction of his neighbors, of those who knew him. Because during that time, if you were in his situation, your options for work would be limited. And so the way he would make his living was making his living as a beggar. And so they say, isn't this the one who used to sit and beg? And he keeps saying that it is him. And they're, I don't know. I think he just looks like him. He just bears a really strong resemblance to him. It can't be the one that we've known for years and years. We remember the day that he was born. We know what he's dealt with from the time he was born. Surely this can't be different now. See, he had gone through this physical process and there was a miraculous gift of healing and they couldn't understand it. And this physical process actually leads to some interesting results. Because what ends up happening in verse 10, they ask him, how are your eyes open? He answers in verse 11, the man who is called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went away and washed and I received sight. There's that physical process of the miraculous healing here. He described it very simply. They said to him, where is he? And he said, I do not know. So in verse 13, they brought to the Pharisees the man who was formerly blind. Now it was Sabbath on the day when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees were asking him again how he received his sight. And he said to them, he applied clay to my eyes, and I washed, and I see. He's repeating that story over and over again. Therefore, some of the Pharisees were saying, this man is not from God because he does not keep the Sabbath. But others were saying, how can a man who is a sinner perform such signs? And they said to the blind man again, what do you say about him since he opened your eyes? And he said, he is a prophet. Let's pause right there for just a moment. There's a physical process taking place here, but there's also a spiritual process that we see happening in this blind man's understanding of Jesus. A couple of weeks ago in our Sunday morning class, we talked about the woman at the well in John chapter 4 and how there's a progression there that she doesn't go just immediately from seeing Jesus and then understanding he's the Messiah. There's a progression where she realizes that he's a Jewish teacher at first, but then there's something about him that she perceives he is a prophet, and then she starts talking about the Messiah, and then he reveals who he is. We see a very similar progression here in John chapter 9. Because at first, Jesus is just a man who came up to him and put clay in his eyes and sent him to Siloam, but now he's describing him as a prophet in verse 17. So you see the process beginning. And then he'll go through in verse 18, the Jews did not believe it of him, that he'd been blind and had received sight, until they called the parents of the very one who had received his sight. So now his parents are coming before the Pharisees, and they question them, saying, is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see? His parents answered them and said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but how he now sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself. This man's parents were not being very helpful. The reason is because, as we'll find out later, expulsion from the synagogue was a very serious thing. They were afraid of being cast out. Verse 22, his parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews. For the Jews had already agreed that if anyone confessed him to be Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. For this reason, his parents said, he is of age, ask him. So now they come to this blind man a second time. A second time they called the man who had been blind and said to him, give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner. They're already stacking the deck against Jesus. And then he answered, whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. So they said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? He answered them, I told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? You do not want to become his disciples too, do you? Well, we can see how that question would set them off. In verse 28, they reviled him and said, you were his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he is from. The man answered and said to them, well, here is an amazing thing, that you do not know where he is from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is God-fearing and does his will, he hears him. And just a side note, the verse, we know that God does not hear sinners, is a quote from the blind man. So just let's remember that as we think about the implications of that statement. It's a quote from him. Since the beginning of time, it has never been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. They answered him, you were born entirely in sins, and you are teaching us. So they put him out. So now by verse 33, he realizes this is a man from God. First he was a man, then he was a prophet. Now he's a man sent from God. And then in verse 35, Jesus approaches him and says, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? Jesus said to him, you have both seen him, and he is the one who is talking with you. And he said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. He believed Jesus as the Son of Man, and he worshipped him. As we think about that process, it didn't happen all at once, but the more he thought about what was happening, and he defends him to the Pharisees, and as he speaks with Jesus, he realizes who Jesus is. And so we see the blind receiving sight. But there are also some here who are spiritually blind that are rejecting sight. And before I'm too hard on the Pharisees, I need to stop and think about how they would have seen themselves, about how they would have seen their job as religious leaders. I'd like to read for you something from Deuteronomy chapter 13. and the warnings there against idolatry, we read beginning in verse 1, "If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes true concerning which he spoke to you, saying, 'Let us go after other gods whom you have not known, and let us serve them,' you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams. For the Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You shall follow the Lord your God and fear him, and you shall keep his commandments, listen to his voice, serve him and cling to him. But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death, because he has counseled rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery, to seduce you from the way in which the Lord your God commanded you to walk. So you shall purge the evil from among you." There were instructions in the law of Moses to be very careful about someone who came along and claimed to have miraculous powers. To be very wary of anybody who claimed to be able to perform these deeds and then taught something different. Now, do you remember what would really get them upset? In fact, just a chapter earlier, in John chapter 8, what really got them upset about Jesus was when Jesus claimed that before Abraham was, I am. In other words, he was using the divine name of God and saying that he had existed in eternity. Jesus was claiming to be the Son of God, but from their perspective, Jesus would say, "You've searched the Scriptures and the Scriptures testify to me." From their perspective, they didn't understand that, and they were thinking, he's calling us to show him the kind of honor we would give to God, as if he could forgive sins, or as if he could use that name, I am. They'd missed the point. Jesus was fulfilling the prophecies. They'd missed the point. But we can see how they would be worried about anyone who claimed to perform miracles. And because they didn't understand Jesus' role as the Son of God, maybe that gives us a little insight into why they were so upset, even when a miracle took place. Now we can look back through the gift of hindsight and see the ways in which Jesus fulfilled all these prophecies. Yet I wonder sometimes if we're too hard on the Pharisees who were trying to make sense of what was happening. And yet, as we see in this passage, they decide to remain in that state of spiritual blindness. So we think about the blind rejecting sight. There's a physical process that took place here as well. Because they bring this individual before him, they bring his parents before him. They find out that Jesus healed them on the Sabbath day. Technically, making mud or the clay would have been considered work on Sabbath day, a day that you were not supposed to work. And they had built all these traditions as a hedge around that. And so you had all of these rules. And there are several times in the Gospels where we see Jesus reminding them that he's the Lord of the Sabbath. But they were so caught up in the Sabbath day that they lost sight of the miracle. They were caught up about when he did it. He healed on the Sabbath day. Not only that, but as we see Jesus healing, that physical act of healing the blind was actually evidence of the Messiah. There are several passages that we see in the book of Isaiah, for example, that Jesus would quote when he goes into the synagogue in Luke chapter 4. He would quote from Isaiah 61 verses 1 and 2 that he's there to fulfill that prophecy that the blind will see. In Matthew 11 and verse 5, when John the Baptist sends this emissary to Jesus and saying, "Are you the one or should we wait for someone else?" Part of Jesus' response is that the blind see. That was evidence for the Messiah. He was giving them evidence that he was who he claimed to be. And previous miracles had also confirmed his identity. At this point in John, we've already seen in John chapter 2, the water turned to wine. We've seen a man healed in John chapter 5, the feeding of the 5,000. We've seen all these miracles, and yet at the same time, they were overlooking those miracles and the fulfillment of prophecy, and they were so fixated on what had happened, and surely this man couldn't be from God, and surely this must be a sinner. They weren't allowing themselves to see what the blind man had seen. There's a spiritual process as well that was taking place. They were more focused on the Sabbath than the miracle. They even doubted that a miracle had actually taken place. They intimidated the parents. Expulsion from the synagogue, again, was a very major thing because the synagogue didn't just function as a place of worship. It was almost like the kind of the community center. That's where children were educated, was at the synagogue. That's where meetings we would think of like a town hall kind of meeting, when people conferred. That happened at the synagogue. If you were cut off from that, you were really, in a very real way, cut off from your community. And so we can imagine how scared they might have been. I also think it's interesting that as they discuss what happened with this man, eventually they begin to insult his character. They say, oh, you were born completely in sin. They've still got the mindset from the very first part of the chapter where the apostles were saying, who sinned, this man or his parents? They say, you were born completely in sin, and here you're going to lecture us. Have you ever noticed that in an argument or that in debate, there's a tendency, if you run out of things to say, to just attack the person's character or to attack who that person is? Well, here's what's happened. They can't respond to what he's saying to them, so they finally start saying, well, we can't learn from you. You were born entirely in sin, and you're here to lecture us. And so they revile him. They revile this man who had done nothing other than be healed of his blindness and be honest about it. I love reading his responses throughout this chapter because at every turn he's open and honest. I don't know what happened, but here's how I began to see. I'm not sure who he is. I'm not sure where he is, but here's what's happening. And so we see them choosing to remain blind. They had seen what had happened, and yet they chose to react to remain blind. It reminds me of our tendency to have certain blind spots, maybe even in our life. If you've driven, especially a long distance, you've probably learned that when you're on the interstate, you might be able to check your mirrors pretty regularly, but most vehicles will have a kind of blind spot. And so if you're on the interstate driving, before you change lanes, it's always good to make sure, well, is there anything in my blind spot? Is there anything that I can't see? And as I think about the Pharisees here in this passage, before I'm too quick to point a finger at them, I might need to ask myself if there are blind spots in my own life. If there are spots I've chosen to remain in the dark. If there are areas of my life that I've decided, well, I've got this under control and I don't really need to be looking for what God wants me to do. It's easy to feel like we're self-sufficient. It's easy to feel like we can handle things on our own. And when we do that, it seems like we're falling in the same trap of the Pharisees. I don't need to listen to anyone else because I've already mapped out what I'm going to do with my life. It's interesting if you've ever been on a campaign where you go door knocking, and if you've ever done that and you're advertising for an upcoming a seminar or a VBS, it's amazing how many more responses usually come from places that are lower income homes, people who are struggling, than those who are very wealthy, those who are well-to-do. I wonder if the reason isn't because when we have stuff and we accumulate things, we kind of think that we've got it under control. I've got my life under control. I'm pretty self-sufficient. I don't need any help. And we develop a blind spot and we forget about our need for God. Or sometimes there are things in our life that we know aren't right, but we've done them long enough, they've just become a normal part of our routine now. And they're sinful habits that we've tolerated so long that now it's just kind of a part of who we are, and surely it won't matter that much, and it's not that big a deal, and we develop a blind spot. As I read through John chapter 9, I need to ask myself, am I looking through my life through a lens that sees everything? Things that I think I keep hidden from others, or ways in which I've sort of gotten used to doing things that aren't right. Do I have any blind spots in my life that I need to examine more closely? It's easy to see it in someone else. It's easy for me to look at the Pharisees and see that, but it's harder for me to look at my own life. Do we have any blind spots? It's interesting to me to see what happens at the beginning of this chapter. Jesus' apostles surveyed the situation and they thought they knew exactly what had happened. There were two options. Here's what it is. Either his parents sinned or he sinned. And Jesus says neither of those things are true. And he proceeds to open their eyes. As I think about the statement we began the lesson with, they saw my blindness as a flaw in my faith. We know that's not true on a physical level. And the exciting news of Scripture is that if we find out I've been spiritually blind, I haven't been seeing what I need to see, I haven't been living the way I need to live, we don't have to stay that way. We don't have to stay in the dark spiritually because we know who the light of the world is. Jesus has let us know that several times in these three chapters, and we see it all throughout Scripture. It's interesting to me that this man was sent to the pool of Siloam, and when he obeyed Jesus' instructions, he was healed. It seems to me like there's a good parallel for us. Some we've questioned before, well, why is baptism so important? Well, we might look at this chapter. Why was the pool of Siloam so important? It was important because he was obeying the commands of Christ. So when I come to God, when I'm ready to turn my life around, I want to obey the commands He's given me. I want to decide to confess His name and put Him on in baptism. And we've seen a picture physically here of a blind man who comes up out of the water seeing. And as we come up out of the water of baptism, we can have the assurance of salvation and the excitement of being able to live the Christian life. If that's not a reality for you, if you haven't made that decision, you can make that decision tonight. Or if there's something else that you'd like encouragement for or something that needs to be addressed in your life, if we can help you in any way, please come as we stand, as we sing together.
With Jesus, the question comes to you.